Good morning and welcome to this December 2nd, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who write from those of us who publish. Whether it's fiction or nonfiction, we do it all. And shockingly, I'm bringing back some short story writers this morning because we all know how much I love short stories. It's my pleasure to welcome Anthony Mara. And in the second half, Karen Bender will be on with her National Book Award finalist, Refund. So stay tuned for that. But first, Anthony. Anthony Mara is the New York Times bestselling author of A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, long listed for the National Book Award, and winner of the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Award in Fiction, and a Barnes & Noble Discovery Award. He is back with a stunning collection set in Russia and Chechnya. The Tsar of Love and Techno is what we're talking about this morning. It's published by Hogarth, and we're going to talk about that and more this morning. Anthony, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for calling in all the way from Berlin, Germany.
Yes.
So you
I am
won.
I'm calling in from the future, 9 hours ahead.
9 hours ahead. So you can tell us all about, sort of a dovetail on this fantastic collection. But so you won the Berlin Prize, which is what took you to Berlin. So just kind of take us into where you are right now with your life, living in Berlin, and what's going on with being there.
Yeah, I received the Berlin Prize from the American Academy, which is a sort of artistic and scholarly institute here in Berlin that brings over American artists and scholars, I suppose, to work in sort of with and social community at large. And I've been busily actually working away on a new novel set in Los Angeles, of all places. So it seems like I always need to be about nine time zones away from whatever subject I'm working on to really get into it, it seems.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a little bit. But so before we dive into the collection, talk a little bit about your draw to Russia and Chechnya. Sort of what it is about this culture, this history, these people that drew you in so deeply and for so long?
It's a great question, and it really begins with books, I think. Ever since I was a high school student, I suppose, I've been drawn to the great Russian classics, people like, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Lermontov and Pushkin, and these books that ask some of the questions that I think we all sort of on the margins of our daily lives worry about. How do I live? How do I live decently? What are my limits of compassion and my capacity for betrayal? How do I walk through a fallen world with some degree of dignity and grace? And I think in American culture, particularly, we're a little bit suspicious of those questions, as if we mistrust the very sincerity with which they're asked. And I really admired the way that so many of these classic Russian books really, really dealt with them head on. And when I was a college student, I went to St. Petersburg to study for a semester, and I sort of fell in love with the culture and history, and these incredible swings, these extremes of climate and geography and politics. If you look at 20th century Russian history, it's almost like this great comet on which you just want to pin the tail of the stories you want to tell, I suppose.
It does seem, because I also had a fascination with Russia, and I traveled to St. Petersburg only for 2 days, not for a whole semester, but I just think it's a wonderful culture. But I felt there's something sort of impenetrable to me about the Russian mind, and accessing the Russian mindset and tapping into that level of sort of their pain. I mean, between the weather and the terrain and the food shortages and, Stalin and the degrees in which people sort of betray each other, all the operatic emotions that you were just talking about felt so kind of inaccessible to me. And I was wondering how you got the voices of these characters so wonderfully. I mean, I don't know if it's right or not because I don't live there, but just kind of accessing the what mindset feels so foreign to Americans.
Well, I grew up in a Catholic family, so I think I understand the authoritarian mindset. just kidding. It's a great question, and it's partially, an act of research. You know, spending time there. I've read, you know, my bookshelves are largely composed of research materials, but I also think it's about trying to do the research that I think only sort of takes place in the imagination, that when we read a work of fiction and it feels true to us, it's not because necessarily the right things were happening on the right dates. That it's because characters, react in emotionally and psychologically realistic and truthful ways that ring honest to us as readers, even if we have no direct experience with whatever it is that those characters are going through. I think that for me, as a reader, the beauty of fiction is that I've always seen it as a tunnel that can take me through the center of the earth, and that I can emerge on the other side next to people I would never otherwise meet. And I think that that's really been my goal as a writer, to have that same sort of transformative, transportative experience that I seek as a reader.
Yeah. No one is more delighted when a novelist comes out with a collection of short stories than I am, because I'm just a fanatic for the form. And Adam Johnson writing that, wonderfully sweeping novel of North Korea, and then coming out with a collection of short stories, just made me clap my hands. So talk a little bit about, writing the novel Constellation and then coming to the short story form afterward. I know you said that the people who asked what book was coming next, and when you told them it was a collection of short stories, they sort of cringed. That's usually not what your publicist wants to hear. So talk a little bit about the short story form, what it did for you, and why you decided to do that after writing a novel.
Yeah, I actually was working on these short stories sort of concurrently with the novel, that every time I finished a draft of Constellation, I would switch over to a short story or two to sort of cleanse the palate, I suppose, between drafts. And so by the time I finished Constellation, I more or less had a finished collection of short stories. And I... at the time, about 3 years ago, they were completely unconnected from each other, these individual short stories. And over the next several years, I really began to want to see how I could arrange the architecture of this collection so that it would have the sort of capacious feel of a novel while being composed of the short story as its sort of atomic unit, I suppose. I think that as you said, there's this sort of knee-jerk reaction among many readers to be predisposed to not want to read a short story collection. But I think that this idea that short stories are sort of the minor leagues doesn't really do justice to the form, because all short stories, but I think particularly this kind of linked, interconnected format allows you to actually be much more ambitious and allows you to spread over a much larger chronological period, over a much larger cast of characters than you could possibly shoehorn into a novel. And so with The Tsar of Love and Techno, it covers about an 80-year span. It covers, dozens of characters, all of which I think the form allows to cohere in a way that wouldn't necessarily be possible were it to be styled as a more traditional novel.
Right. I totally agree. And it does seem like the short story is enjoying sort of a renaissance these days, that you see it, you know, it's been winning the Pulitzer. It just feels like it's on bookshelves more than it had been maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But I hope that's true.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you mentioned Adam Johnson's short story collection, which I read earlier this year. And, you know, if ever there was a book to point to in terms of, you know, the tremendous power that the form can attain when it's being worked by a master, I think that's it.
Yeah. So we're a third of the way through the interview, and I haven't even really let you talk about the book yet. So I should give you a chance to introduce the collection. We've talked around it, but maybe you can kind of properly introduce The Tsar of Love and Techno.
Yeah, it's a collection of these tightly linked short stories that is set over nearly 100 years of Russian history. It begins in the 1930s with a man named Roman Markin. Roman is a portrait artist who is tasked by the Soviet authorities to begin erasing images of dissenters, beginning with his own brother, who had been recently arrested. And this was actually one of the first widespread uses of the airbrush was in the Soviet Union in the 1930s. It was not only considered traitorous. It was considered a traitorous act to simply have an image of a traitor, and so images of the enemies of the people had to be literally destroyed or erased. And so this former portrait artist instead finds himself airbrushing out the faces of Stalin's enemies. And as he does this, he begins to start drawing these little postage stamp-sized portraits of his own brother, who had been condemned by the regime, into the backgrounds of all of these photographs and paintings that he censors and retouches. And it sort of acts as these little narrative time bombs, almost. Nobody in his era realize that this is happening, and they sort of wait throughout the course of the book as it moves to Siberia, to Chechnya, to St. Petersburg, as it moves through the dissolution of the Soviet Union into the Wild West crony capitalism of the 1990s into the present day.
That's a great description. I could not have done that, but well done. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
One thing that strikes me about Russia, and this book really sort of highlights, is the rich tradition of art in a culture that is so downtrodden. And, you know, whether it's their music or their visual arts or their ballet, Russia seems so richly steeped in the arts. And this book highlights so many of those different arts in the writing itself. Do you think there's a connection between people's pain and the great art that comes out of it?
Oh, that's a terrific question, and one that I really don't have an answer to. You know, I think that that certainly some of the great Russian artists, you know, just thinking I went to a concert yesterday of Shostakovich, and his Seventh Symphony was written and performed among the brutal siege of Leningrad. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think that that level of pain or suffering is at all necessary to creating magnificent art. I do think, though, that there is this incredibly rich and very proud tradition of it over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, and it became, as you mentioned, sort of the book is filled with these passing nods to some of the greats and some of the lesser well-known Russian artists and writers and composers that have meant a lot to me.
Yeah. There's a wonderful story in here about a ballerina who is made to dance or put on these ballets during, it was some period during the Stalin era, right?
Yeah.
Where they're
yeah.
bringing these moments of light and beauty to this incredibly dark place. And the contrast in here is so wonderful. These moments of grace and dignity amongst, you know, the worst possible human conditions. You know, it's really lovely. Really lovely.
My guess. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, just that, that I think in this book I was particularly interested in seeing both those moments where art certainly has the power to redeem these characters in some way, but how it also equally has the capacity to corrupt and to coerce. That this portrait artist, for instance, in the first story that we mentioned, has been trained to create faces, and instead his training is co-opted, and he ends up erasing faces. And I think art, as is the case with most things, has equal capacities to enrich and to plunder. That a hammer can be used to build something or to knock something down.
Yeah, this idea of erasing people not only off the face of the earth by executing them, but erasing them all documentation relating to them. And you were talking about school children in Russia being trained to dip their finger in the inkwell and stamp out the faces of descendants in their history books. The whole idea of it is so visceral and powerful, to just eliminate all evidence of somebody off the face of the earth, both pictorially and literally. That I don't know what it is that speaks to my psyche about that, but it's a really powerful idea.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is, in part because it sort of demonstrates the aim, at least, of the Soviet government at the time. The idea that not only are they capable of stealing the breath from your lungs, but you are so inconsequential and you are so small compared to the might of this government, that your entire life, everything you've done, can be just wiped away. That everybody you've loved, every graduation diploma you've received, every time card at your place of work, every object that has some residue of your personhood on it can be taken, can be polished, can be completely made new to exist without you. That sense that you have no control not only of your life in the present moment, but everything that has come before, I think, is toxic to the mind, to our sense of who we are as people. And I think that's why the idea of erasing all pictorial evidence of a person is, in its own way, as sort of malicious and as violent, as brutal as actually taking that person's life.
Yeah. Toxic is a great word. Yeah, toxic to the mind is a great word. My guest this morning is Anthony Mara. The book is The Tsar of Love and Techno, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I also have to mention, the book is incredibly funny. I mean, there are really a number of laugh-out-loud lines of both dialogue and thought. And so balancing, I think humor is never better than when it's interwoven with tragedy. And can you talk a little bit about getting the voice of humor right when the circumstances are so bleak, if that was conscious or if that's just kind of part of your organic process?
Yeah, it's certainly something I completely agree with. Where, as you mentioned, that sort of the darker a book goes, the more, you know, the more necessary I think humor is. I think I'm essentially a comic writer who just ends up writing tragedies, the tragic nature, I think, of these stories is what sort of maybe throws the comedic elements into relief, and vice versa. I think that you need, you know, a broad tonal range in any work, but when you're particularly playing the bass end of the keyboard, those higher notes become all the more essential. But I also think it's part of maybe the daily sort of milieu of many of the characters that I write about. Chechnya, for instance, which features in several of these stories, is probably not a place where we think of a lot of jokes being cracked. But when I traveled there to research parts of this book, I was myself the subject, usually the butt of a lot of jokes. The people that the locals that were showing me around would often have this incredible capacity to zero in on the one thing that you're most afraid of, and then tease you mercilessly for it. And so, you know, I was afraid of getting kidnapped. And so there were all sorts of, you know, kidnapping jokes that were tossed in my direction. And it's both a way, I think, of laughing. Who doesn't like to laugh? But also of deflating the power of what you're most afraid of. That if you can make a joke about something, then it can be a deadly serious thing. It can be, you know, this form of self-defense. And I think that's frequently the case in some of these, you know, incredibly dark places and some of these very dark situations. About 2 years ago, I was talking with a Chechen man who now lives in America, who had been brutally tortured by the Russian army there, and he was describing this experience of being tortured, and his wife was sitting next to him, and he had the biggest grin on his face, and he was making jokes, and his wife was crying, and at one point she asked him, "Why are you laughing? Like, this isn't funny." And he responded and said that that was the only way he could make sense of it. And so I think for a lot of these characters, the sort of dark gallows humor that suffuses the book is a way of making sense of a world that has maybe veered off the course of logic and reason some time ago.
You raise a really interesting point. Maybe you've already answered the question that I would ask, but it strikes me that humor is often really culturally specific. You know, it's either based on references or language or idioms or experiences. And so I was wondering if you had to worry about that when you were writing the humor in the book, that not having, you know, been steeped in their language or growing up, if their humor was different than our humor. And it sounds like it is, but it sounds like you were also able to tap into it.
Yeah, I mean, certain things like, you know, puns, for instance, are usually entirely specific to a given language and wouldn't translate in either direction. But you see it in old Soviet Union jokes that make total sense in English with just a bare bit of historical knowledge. So the subjects of the joke are often culturally specific, but I think the underlying machinery of humor is something that perhaps does not really resist that kind of translation.
Yeah. So I understand that when you put the book together, there were three stories that got cut out of it and three stories that got written to go into it. If you can talk a little bit about, not too much going into what those three stories were, maybe, but knowing what's not working, knowing what to abandon, and you know, what the cues were that these stories aren't going to make it, and what stories needed to be in there to make the collection cohesive.
Yeah, well, I sort of because I had these various stories that were unconnected, I sort of had them laid out in front of me and almost saw them as, you know, points on a map, and I had to figure out a way of you know, driving the vehicle of the book through each of these points on the map. And some of those points were just too far afield. And I couldn't figure out a way of really detouring toward them without, you know, upsetting the entire journey. So those ended up getting excised. But I was really trying to focus on ways of collapsing stories, collapsing characters and settings. There were these repeated motifs throughout the book that, you know, totally without my conscious or deliberate intentionality kept popping up in these originally discrete stories, such as blindness and these various forms of art as both, you know, forms of redemption and as forms of coercion. The Chechen conflict came up again and again. Outer space was something that came up again and again. The very last story in the collection is actually set in outer space, and I knew that I wanted that to be the end of the book. And so a lot of the rewrites and a lot of the, you know, this sort of 2-year process of piecing this all together was geared toward figuring out how I was going to get from a book that begins in the 1930s in a room at the end of a metro tunnel in Leningrad, how I was going to get from there to outer space in the final story. And so I did sort of see it a lot as these places on a map that I was trying to steer toward.
Ambitious. There's so much to talk about. I really wanted to get to the Greek chorus story of talking in that voice and all of your music. I want to tell our listeners that if you go onto Anthony's website, which is anthonymara.net, there's a whole soundtrack to the, you know, if you're wondering what this mixtape is on the cover, and the mixtape makes an appearance throughout the book. The mixtape is on your website, and so I was able to listen to a lot of the music while reading the book.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you.
Yeah, so just before I ask my last question, just talk a little bit about the kind of the importance of music, how much you were listening to when you were assembling the book, and kind of how the soundtrack came to be.
Yeah, it's the soundtrack was sort of my attempt to create a mixtape that would mirror the experience of reading the book. I sort of envisioned the structure of the book as a mixtape because I think that a good story collection functions a lot like a mixtape. That mixtapes aren't just an assortment of random songs, but rather they are these individual pieces that that go into creating an emotional narrative, a narrative arc that is hopefully going to be larger than the sum of its parts. And that ended up being the inspiration for this actual mixtape that is woven throughout the book and makes an appearance in a different form, I suppose, on this Spotify track list that I made.
So cool. You'll hear the Nutcrackers. You've never heard it before, which is so fun.
Absolutely.
So throughout your experiences at Iowa and SC and writing a novel and writing a collection of short stories, is there advice you can leave our writing audience of what has worked the best for you as a writer and, you know, sort of wisdom through the trenches that you can impart?
Oh, wow. That is, that's a very good question. I suppose, you know, the things that have worked for me have always been trying to break things down into their smallest, most manageable pieces. Right now I'm working on this new novel, and, you know, it's going to be a long one, and it's terrifying, and it's just too big for me to fit in my head. And when I think of it in its entirety, I just want to, you know, curl up in bed and pull the pillow over my head. But I can think about it in terms of 1,000-word increments, and that's usually about as much as I can write in a day, 1,000 words. And I can't really think, hold in my head, you know, what a 150,000-word novel looks like, but I can sort of hold in my head what a novel composed of 150 that individual 1,000-word increments would look like. And that I found more than anything has been useful in the first draft. And for subsequent drafts, I think retyping is maybe the best advice I could pass on. I retype everything, you know, multiple times, and each time I think not only does the language get more refined, but you begin to sort of see these multiple versions in your own memory, in your own imagination of what you're creating. And I think the result ends up being clearer and deeper and more powerful than maybe you could get to if you were simply, inserting edits with a red pen.
Very interesting. I could talk to you for, you know, days, but sadly.
Oh, likewise.
Sadly, we could. So finish that very long novel, and we'll resume where we left off here.
Excellent. That'd
Wonderful.
Be terrific.
That was Anthony Mara. The book is The Tsar of Love and Techno. You can find more about Anthony online, anthonymara.net. As I mentioned, there's the mixtape. He traveled to Chechnya for research, and he's got a lot of really wonderful photographs up there. So check him out at anthonymara.net. This collection is fantastic. We are going to take a very short break. Karen Bender will be back when we come back from that break. So until then, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org.com. It's only that I've been doing this 10 years. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And we are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. There is no reason not to listen. You can always go on to Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. We have direct downloads to all of our past shows on there. There are hundreds and hundreds. The show's been going for, I think, close to 18 years. So if there is an author you are looking for, be it a mystery writer, literary fiction, Pulitzer Prize winners, Booker Prize winners, and today, National Book Award finalists, they will all be up there. It is my pleasure to continue the short story ball rolling. Karen Bender is with me now. Karen is the author of the story collection Refund, published by Counterpoint Press this year. It is a finalist for the National Book Award in Fiction and is on the short list for the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Prize. It was also an LA Times bestseller. She is also the author of the novels Like Normal People, which was a LA Times bestseller, a Washington Post Best Book of the Year, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection, and A Town of Empty Rooms. Her short fiction has appeared all over the place, including The New Yorker, Granta, Plowshares. I first found Karen in Best American Short Stories back in 1997, where she had a story called Eternal Love, which I suggest the moment this interview is over, you drop everything you're doing and go find it and read it. She is published in the Best American Mystery Stories and New Stories from the South. This year's best has been, and she has won 2 Pushcart Prizes. 2 of her stories have been read in the Selected Shorts program on NPR, and she's received grants from the National Endowment of the Arts and the Rona Jaffe Foundation. She's the co-editor of the nonfiction anthology Choice, True Stories About Birth, Contraception, Infertility, Adoption, Single Parenthood, and Abortion. She's taught MFAs all over the place. She went to Iowa. The rest you can look up on her website, karenbender.com. which I highly recommend. She's got a bunch of interviews up there. She's got lots of amazing writing advice and more. Karen, quite the introduction. Hello.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be on.
I could have really gone on and on, but, you know, I want to talk to you. So, so the stories in Refund have been published in various journals for like 10 years. So this collection has been, it looks like it's been long in the making. So I'm going to let you talk about it kind of generally and assembling the stories and, you know, what themes were on your mind and sort of how Refund came together.
Okay, good question. Yeah, I mean, I started Refund after I finished my first novel, Like Normal People, which took about 7 years to write. I'm pretty slow in terms of writing, and I really wanted to write things that were shorter. And I had our first child, our son, and I really felt like my mind could best encapsulate this story form, and it really is my favorite form to write in. And so I started writing. The first story actually that came out was Best, which is about the swimmer on the cruise ship, which actually evolves sort of naturally from Like Normal People, because I really like inhabiting an older woman's point of view. The character, main character in that story, is 80, in her 80s, I think. And Like Normal People, one of the main characters was a grandmother. So I really liked that perspective, and I wanted to explore that. And then I wrote the stories Refund and Anything for Money, and it was, I just thought, there seems to be a theme here about money and issues about money. And it's funny because I, at that point, I got an NEA grant, and they said, you have to tell us what you're going to work on. And so I have this little paragraph, and I went and looked at it recently on the site, and it's basically, it sounds like the cover, like copy for the book, which is, you know, these are stories that issue that focus on issues of money and worth. And so it was something that was sort of in my mind for a long time then. And I kept working on the stories, and some had dealt with money, some did not as much. And then I actually, when we were going to try and sell them, it sounded like it was easy to try and sell with a novel. So I was working on the Town of Jerusalem. Although it ended up harder, actually, we tried to sell it in 2010, which was a terrible time for publishing.
Yeah.
It's very hard to find that book and then this book. But then I found kind of hard press, and they became my home.
I love it.
So that was just really great.
I love it. I love it. It almost strikes me as like a State of the Union collection. You know, it's got it's got, you know, all of our. Well, our two economic downturns since the turn of the century,
right.
And religion and politics and money,
right.
And 9/11. I mean, a lot of it's universal human experience, but a lot of it really felt very uniquely American. And I was wondering if you agree with that, if you see it as sort of a distinctly American collection.
That's a great question. I mean, I think what I found is happening in my writing, I mean, in this book anyway, is I guess interact with things that are going out in the outside world and connect them to internal states of the characters and look at characters' individual psychologies and how they are affected by experiences like 9/11, like, you know, like random shootings, like you know, the rise of the religious right. I mean, how does that affect people in different ways?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of the story Thief that you talked about before in writing from a older woman's point of view. So she's an older woman who's got either dementia or Alzheimer's, or she's slipping off. And I always think it's really hard to write from an Alzheimer's point of view. I've tried to do that. It's really difficult.
Uh-huh.
Are there, so talk a little bit about accessing voice of people that are losing their memory, unreliable narrators, and, you know, whether that was uniquely challenging or kind of how you access an Alzheimer's mindset.
Wow. That's an interesting question. I mean, with all characters, you have to find something in yourself, no matter how different the character is from you, you know, so kind of personally, you have to find something in them that relates to the character, but then I think you can explode out, you know, and develop. I mean, I think what I want to get in her is just this feeling of isolation and vulnerability, and the feeling that you can't quite control your mind, which I think is something that maybe everyone has in some point in some other way, you know, if not with Alzheimer's, maybe with, you know, other things that can go through your mind. So I think that's what I tried to find in myself that then I just sort of exploded in her.
Yeah. You have such a great candid eye on parenting. I mean, it's really easy to fall into sentiment about parenting because, you know, everyone's a little in love with their kids, or humor because kids are funny. But this is really real and raw and in the trenches of, I mean, I'm glad I already have a kid because I wouldn't have a kid after reading this. But I was wondering sort of, I mean, you're a parent yourself, so I assume a lot of that gets in here. But this unique experience of writing about parenting from the really raw emotional parts, I don't know. I don't even know what my question is here. But if you can talk a little bit about your wonderfully unique perspective on parenting.
Oh, thanks. Well, I mean, it's interesting because I know before I became a parent, I really wanted to read work that was about parenting in a way that was really felt really more real. And I know I found Helen Simpson, who has this wonderful short story collection called Getting a Life. She's a British writer, really funny and really and quite dark, but I think really nuanced, you know, in ways that I think are important. I mean, and I was answering this question that they had this National Book Award event in Miami, and they asked a question, you know, right, how do you write about parenting? I said, well, in a way, parenting, I think, it's like the most cutified experience in our culture. You know, the fact that you get these little onesies covered with elephants and, you know, trains, you know, when a child is born distracts you from the fact that you are not going to sleep for many months, you know, and, you know, then there's this incredible profundity about raising children and, you know, that it's about connection and love and separation and, you know, the unknowability of your child and, you know, independence and mortality and time, you know, all these things are in that relationship. If you look at it, you know, relatively closely, you know, So I really want to write about that, and I think these things are actually made even more powerful when you put them against then the cultural events going around it. Like it was really interesting writing about parenting and against the backdrop of 9/11.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a really important story for me to write because we actually lived near Ground Zero around that time, and you could see, you know, all the issues of parenting were just magnified, you know, with this in the backdrop. So I think it just, I wanted to do honor to all of its, you know, interesting elements.
Right, right. And how it affects marriage and the mobile effect of the family and how kids tip it just off to the depths of the ocean.
I mean, I think it's just really, and I guess why are people afraid of writing about it? Because somehow maybe I feel like culture is kind of afraid of honesty in some way, that if you're honest about things, it somehow is threatening. But I actually found honesty really healing myself.
Yeah.
I think it's really connecting, and people read it, and no one has said, you know, oh my God, how can you write, you know, this. They're like, oh, you know, I feel that way too. And I do feel like that's one way I started writing is, and from, you know, one of the first really powerful reading experiences I had, which was Catcher in the Rye when I was 16. And I read that, and it was one of the first books that said, oh, I don't feel alone. Someone else feels this way. And I do feel that's one of the great connecting elements about fiction. If you write something and people say, oh, I feel that way too, I'm
absolutely
not alone. And I think that's really, it's really great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is the great draw to story. Yeah. And then it doesn't matter if it's fiction or nonfiction. I mean, the emotional truth is true, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
My guest this morning is Karen Bender. The book is Refund. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So to tap into your MFA professorship here, I was looking at a lot of these stories as sort of two strands. Most of these stories had two strands that were sort of braided together, two distinct storylines. Some of it was backstory, you know, braided with present story, or, you know, a character has a life outside her family and then a life with her family that get braided together. So talk a little bit about you're the master of the short story, what you've learned in constructing short stories, if my two-strand theory is correct, or if, I don't know, just sort of what fundamental principles work when you're constructing a short story.
Oh, it's so interesting, two strands. I'll have to now reread them and try to find them. I guess, I mean, when I teach stories, or I teach writing generally, in terms of plot, I tell my students to look at a question. There has to be a narrative question that goes through the whole story that keeps you reading, that creates an urgency for the reader. One of those is the horizontal line, which is about plot and what happens just on a very sort of activity, you know, level in terms of action. And then there's also a vertical line, which is about emotion. And each scene has to sort of relate to that. Hmm. I don't know if I think of it in two strands. I do have this theory about creating scope in stories, which is called the octopus moment, which I've taught in various places. But basically, the idea with that is that plot is also kind of like an octopus, and the main plot is the body of the octopus, and the backstory and the future and, you know, little elements that give the story a feeling of scope, and that the characters can step out of the story, you know, onto the rest of their lives are kind of the tentacles. Mm. And there are several stories I look at where you look at how a writer creates a momentum with the kind of main body and then has a tentacle, it flies out and brings in some backstory and gives the story scope. There's a Raymond Carver story I teach often called These Actual Miles, which is a fantastic story about a couple that's trying to sell a car that's about to be taken because they're about to go bankrupt. Or they're declaring bankruptcy. And so the first thing they're arguing really intently about the wife's going to go sell the car. And then there's like one paragraph flashback in that scene where you have a neighbor watching how the husband brought a woman home like several months before. And then that's it. It's all the information we have. So it's a little backstory that informs the rest of the narrative. So I just remember when I noticed that, I just loved the fact that you could really create a lot of range or scope in a story with just a little bit of carefully placed information. So I do think about that when I construct stories.
Yeah, actually, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the story Thief. And you, so same story with your Alzheimer's woman. And she, I really like this octopus. I've never thought of the octopus tentacle flashing back. And in that story, I was going to ask you about backstory overwhelming. It never overwhelms the current momentum of the story. It gives you just enough information to understand her. And it feels like in a lesser writer's hands, it would be very easy to just slip completely into backstory and forget, you know, we're forgetting we're on the cruise ship and now we're just, you know, growing up with this woman. Are there kind of rules that you follow when you say, you know what, enough backstory, time to get back to present day, in terms of balancing people's history with what's going on and how much you need to inform the current story?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It's a great question. Cause I do tend to sometimes get lost in backstory because, you know, I tend to be very psychoanalytically oriented. It's sort of like a worldview that I really, you know, like and find interesting. So I really like, you know, knowing what motivates the characters, you know, in terms of their past and, you know, so I do tend to write a lot of backstory off, you know, so I think some of which will get cut. I think one thing I do in terms of backstory is think about stories also in terms of conveying information, like in a very kind of technical sense. What information is needed to answer the question you posed? Right. So the question, I guess, that's posed in theft is what is going to happen when she goes on the cruise ship? And then I guess that maybe that's the the horizontal question, but then the vertical question is, you know, why is she stealing all these gifts? What is she compensating for? Why is she acting the way she is? So the backstory there relates. What's supposed to relate to that, and also it sort of dovetails with the character Darlene she meets, who I think is helping her just like reenact her experience with Evelyn in a different way.
Darlene almost seems like the fixed point in which you can see, you know, the Evelyn, or in which you can see her kind of, you know, flying all over the place. Darlene is sort of the North Star. So we know what normal is, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great point. Yeah.
And how do you know when to abandon a story, when a story just isn't working and it's not worth your, it's not worth fixing?
Good question. I think honestly, I don't have that many stories I've actually abandoned. I think if a story is not engaging to me emotionally, I know that something is wrong. You know, if I feel like I'm writing it somehow because I should be writing it, or I'm writing it, you know, for some other reason, I think then it would not work. But I guess I tend to write to answer something that's emotionally sort of powerful to me, or railing around, or some question I want to answer about the outside world or internally. So that's what gets me to the page. So I really feel like I like figuring that out. Is I also believe really strongly in revision to make stories better.
Yes, yes. And yeah. To that point, I'm wondering when you know that a story is finished, because I feel like you could tinker with a story forever and ever and never know when it's actually done. So what tells you, you know what, this is, we're done here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the problem, is it's not a science.
Yeah.
You ultimately have to give it up and say it's done, and I'm sick of it, and I have to move on. And it's the best I can do at the moment. So it's a weird balancing act between, you know, many drafts and really trying to go forward, and then at a certain point saying I need to move on. And I know reading the stories in Refund, I see things I want to change. And when I read from the plans, I'll edit as I read. So it's never ending. It's never ending. And at a certain point, you have to move on.
Which was the story in here that gave you the most headache?
Oh, what a good question. Gosh. I don't know.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer that none of them stands out as saying, oh, God, I wrestled that to the ground for 5 years.
Oh, God. I mean, Refund was a hard story to write. And actually, Theft was pretty hard, too. I mean, none were hard, but I think, none were particularly nightmarish.
I wonder if the farther they are from your own experience, the easier they are to write. I mean, I find that things that are really, really close, you can never say enough about it because, you know, there's all the backstory that played into some event. You just want to say everything. But maybe if a story is a little bit further away from you emotionally, you can get more perspective on it. I don't know.
I think that's a good question. And I think it's a good point, too. It's that sometimes the real life intrudes and also people intrude. Like, you think you're writing something and, you know, it's actually a little, you know, someone that you know is sort of like this and you suddenly feel guilty. And then, you know, actually when you change people and you really transform them, it's easier to write more, sometimes a lot more. So I think that could be true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And over the course of writing for decades now, do you still see yourself coming back to the same questions that interested you, say, you know, in the 90s? Or have your areas of concern changed over time, do you think?
Definitely have changed. I know, like, when I started, like, Normal People, I was in my 20s, and I really wanted to know sort of how to grow up, you know, like, and I wondered what was, like, I wrote that book about motherhood before I became a mother, and I was just trying to figure out what would that be like, you know, and it was really an interesting experience writing that and then inhabiting those characters and trying to figure things out. And it's different than the questions I'd ask now.
Yeah. Last-minute writing advice. I'm going to tell our listeners again that if you go onto Karen's website, she's got endless tips and tricks on revision and writing and her, you know, sort of 10 biblical phrases of short story writing.
Commandments,
yeah, thank you. Biblical phrases. This is how religious I am, Karen. Biblical phrases. But do you have words of advice you can leave us with today?
Oh, I think for writers, really the best advice is just don't stop. You know, I think there are a lot of things in our culture that want to make writers stop writing, which is, you know, just, you know, anything from, you know, creating, you know, a feeling of that you're not doing anything important, or that, you know, that there's kind of a feeling of indifference, but that you're doing something incredibly important. And that if you want to do it, stay with it.
I love it. Karen Bender, I always love your work. I was so excited to see this collection come across the desk. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Karen Bender. Again, you can find her at karenbender.com. The collection is Refund. It is out and available now. It was a National Book Award finalist. It is wonderful. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Teddy, who's going to give you a little bit of reggae coming up. And we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.